Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity.com, welcoming you this Saturday evening, this evening, and every Saturday evening for an educational, enlightening, and entertaining hour. And I welcome all of you again this evening, and it's so glad to be back. I want to say welcome, and I hope everyone across the nation is staying warm in this very, very bitter cold, virtually in every corner of the nation, except maybe where our guest is, but we'll get into that in a minute. And so I want to say I hope that last week everyone appreciated the Missing Persons Marathon that I did with the variety of blogs and different radio shows that we have done over almost 2 years now. And I did that as a tribute to Monica Kayson and her team of searchers. And I just want to give a shout out there today to Monica and all of her team, because they have been working feverishly to try to find missing persons in Horry County, which is the Myrtle Beach area in South Carolina, to find not only Heather Elvis, but a number of other missing persons. And I think they've really done a tremendous job and continue to and try to help raise awareness. So I say, everyone, please, please do go to Monica's website at the Q Center for the Missing NC. Please do donate. Please do look and see what's going on. Try to support their efforts. And with that, I will bring in Delilah, the social media maven of Myrtle Beach, and my good friend and PR manager. Delilah, good evening, and thanks for joining me.
Hi, Donna. It's good to be here, and just like it is every Saturday. And I'm very, very pleased with our guest tonight. I know we have a lot of different topics to cover, and they're all so very important, and I know our listeners will come away with a lot of really good information.
I totally agree. This is our first time with this organization, and we try to be innovative and diverse and not do a lot of repeats. So with that, why don't I bring them on, Delilah, okay?
Sounds good.
Okay. Our guest is Van Levy, who is the National Executive Director of Parents of Murdered Children Incorporated, and a nonprofit that's dedicated to victims' rights for, I believe, the last 35 years or so. And I believe they have expanded their focus just not to be focused on parents necessarily of murdered children, but he can correct me if I'm wrong. But this gentleman is a very esteemed advocate for homicide survivors, because in fact he's learned it from both sides of the fence, both as an advocate in his job, but also he is a homicide survivor himself, having suffered homicide of his brother Howard. And let me tell you a little bit about his background before we bring him on. He not only is the executive director, but he's been a director of the Office of Victim Services of the Office of the Arizona Attorney General, advisor for victims of Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano. Also, he developed comprehensive victim services at the Arizona Department of Corrections. He has really been an expert and focused on trying to improve public policy with regard to treatment of crime victims. He's been on a number of boards, including the state chairman for Mothers Against Drunk Driving, ANOVA, National Organization for Victim Assistance, the Attorney General Arizona Forensic Science Advisory Committee, and on and on. So why don't we just bring him in, and we can talk some more about this. Dan, thank you so much for being with us on Shattered Lives. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, thanks, Donna, and thanks, Delilah. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here, and I appreciate the kind introduction.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you, and we always like to give a national voice to very, very worthy organizations such as yours. And people may have somewhat of a familiarity with POMC. However, can you correct, was my earlier statement correct or incorrect with regard to expanding its focus beyond being a parent of a murdered child? Can anyone who has had a homicide in their family qualify, or is the title a misnomer, or what?
No, it's for families and friends of those who have died by violence. Our name is, of course, the National Organization of Parents of Murdered Children, and just briefly, when we were first founded in Cincinnati, Ohio, by our founders, Robert and Charlotte Hollinger, at that time, it was founded just by a group of parents literally looking for support from others, and started off in the humble beginnings of the Hollinger's basement, and has grown over the years since 1978
mm-hmm.
To include all survivors, friends and family of anyone who's died by violence.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and hopefully that hasn't been a problem with respect to your marketing and whatnot. But
it does make it interesting sometimes, just because it's a group no one wants to belong to, but we
right.
feel like that's what it is murder, and there's no real other way to sugarcoat it, if you will.
That's true. Before I ask you about your personal story and your personal involvement, can you tell me how did you come to become the executive director as you are now of POMC?
Sure. Well, as you had mentioned previously, my background, I was after the tragic murder of my brother, I got involved in victims' rights and victims' issues, and served on the National Organization of Parents of Murdered Children on the National Board of Trustees in that capacity for a number of years, over a decade. And then it was kind of almost 2 years ago when an opening occurred for the executive director, and it was sort of like one of those midlife do I take a leap of faith and go and have the honor of leading an organization? And I looked at it as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and it all fell into place. And the nice part is I'm able to do it from a satellite office in Phoenix, Arizona, and the rest of our staff is in Cincinnati, Ohio, and we communicate on a daily basis, and it works out well.
Well, that's very good. Now, do you have a term of office or, 3-5 years or whatever, and then you get reelected?
Well, I work at the pleasure of the National Board of Trustees, who are my bosses, and so there is no term per se. When you're on the National Board, it's more of a volunteer, or it is a volunteer capacity.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the executive director, our previous executive director was there for over 25 years, so no, there's
wow.
no time limit.
Well, that's big shoes to fill, huh?
It is.
In terms of longevity, but from your colleagues, I hear that you're doing very well, so that's good. With regard, just a little bit on what is entailed in being an executive director for a nonprofit such as POMC? I mean, what's a typical day week like?
Geez. First and foremost, providing services to survivors. I'm on the phone every day talking to survivors, as is our staff, who, and I should mention them, and kudos to them. We have three staff people, actually four part-time person, but They all do wonderful work, and actually we have another part-time person, so five. But, you know, for me, it's primarily raising funds, networking, trying to raise awareness and doing appearances like this to let people know that POMC is here. It's a lot of also working with our staff and overseeing the programs that we have at our national office and the chapters that we have throughout the country, and just ensuring that everything's running smoothly. But I would say most of my time is spent trying to identify and really grab, if we can, funding, because funding is tough to come by for, I think, all nonprofits, and that includes our organization as well, and looking for foundation grants or grants in general, and planning fundraising events and doing what I like to call is, you know, a work of passion or a labor of love, but it's important.
Right. Well, that certainly sounds very familiar to me, because I was one of the founding members of Survivors of Homicide Incorporated in the Hartford, Connecticut area. And so we're all faced with the same thing. And I'm wondering, are we all competing for the same dollars in terms of federal grants?
I think oftentimes we are. And I know, you know, when I've talked to other of my colleagues, in the victims field, it's limited availability of funding, and the amount that is out there, we all seem to try and in one way or another go for it, and sometimes we can collaborate and work together as organizations, but I think in general, you know, it seems like there's less and less funding, and yet we're required to do, or not required, but we certainly want to do more and more, and
right.
It puts us in a tough place as a nonprofit organization.
Mm-hmm. And do you interface a lot with the others, such as NOVA and the National Crime Victim Center, the Von Bülow organization? I mean, you all work collaboratively?
We do. We haven't really applied for any funding recently, but we do work together on conferences and, of course, on public policy issues and legislative issues. We've certainly all got our pulse, I think, on common issues, and if we don't, we will certainly let each other know that, hey, this issue is coming up, or here is maybe an opportunity for funding, or here's when our conference is, or this training. And we're really all in it together to the extent that we can, you know, each help each other. I think we try and do that.
Well, that's good to hear, because we're all doing the same good work, and we should work collaboratively, I think. Maybe people are not aware. Isn't the uniqueness of your organization that you are the only national self-help organization for murder victims in terms of being throughout the country, but not in all 50 states, correct?
Right.
Can you explain
that? Not in every state, but we do have a contact person at least in every state, and as we have over 60 chapters across the United States. Some states have more than others, and people can go on our website, which is www.pomc.com, if they ever, you know, want to look up where a chapter is or if there's one in their area. But we are a national self-help organization that the only one that we know of its kind, in that it's peer support, and really the rubber meets the road for us is with our chapters and our members who offer support, although each case is different. They're similar in the sense that, you know, working with another survivor who got a knock on the door or a phone call that fundamentally changed their life, and trying to help others.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I think there are a couple of other states, such as my state, Survivors of Homicide, and there's Delilah, what's the name of Jean's organization in California again?
Oh, you had to ask me that. It's on the tip of my tongue.
United Crime.
No.
Jean Cervantes. Survivors Against Homicide, isn't it? Survivors Against Homicide?
I think, you know, I should have looked it up before the show.
I should
know that. Embarrassed now. We should know. We're sorry, Jean and Shelley, if you're listening. Anyway, but we know,
but we
and
do
they
have
right. They have recently started a conference as of, I think, last year, their first one. So even though you may have the longevity in terms of 35 years, I think there are those outcroppings. Survivors of Homicide in Connecticut has been here since the early 80s, but again, we have chapters throughout Connecticut, but we don't have the national scope that you do. So I think there are, you know, there are other like organizations, but you are the first. You are unique, you know,
you know, we're all in it together, and I
Citizens
think...
Citizens Against Homicide, that's what it is, right, Delilah?
Citizens Against Homicide.
Citizens
Against Homicide, yes, and they put out a newsletter, and they've had their first conference, I believe it was in Vegas and whatnot, but I shouldn't talk about the competition.
I was just going to say, we don't look at it like that, obviously,
right.
We're all in it together, and I know of that organization, and I think Bill Cosby was at their conference in Vegas.
Absolutely.
Many, many great homicide groups around the country, and we're not everywhere. And I always say, it doesn't have to be POMC, at least first responders and those that work with victims and survivors, and I use that term interchangeably, at least have a tool in your toolbox that whether it's any support group, whether it's POMC or whoever, that at least be available, because the saddest thing, or one of them, is to hear from a survivor, you know, years down the line, that I never knew that there was any help, whoever that group is, and so that's part of raising our awareness.
Yes, that is very sad. Well, tell me this sort of like the chicken and the egg question here, because I'd like to get into. You know, telling your own personal story, as difficult as it is, it always establishes some credibility with our audience. And I wasn't quite clear in terms of dates. Which came first? You're working with the Department of Corrections or your brother's homicide?
My brother's homicide, gone back to school to get my undergraduate in criminal justice and November 3rd, 1996, my brother Howard was waiting to play a game of basketball with his friends and got there a little bit early and was approached by two complete strangers. We later learned, gang members that were looking for somebody to rob and carjacked him and murdered him, a complete random act of violence. And that sort of, I was going to be a juvenile probation officer, and after that, that's sort of the Reader's Digest quick version, but after going through the criminal justice system, I decided I wanted to be an advocate for victims and felt more of a kinship or passion, if you will, for what we had went through, my family and I, and I felt like, you know, I want to try and honor my brother's life and who he was by trying to help someone else, and that's kind of what I've done. So that was really the impetus for me getting involved in victims' rights and victim services was his tragic murder, but I felt like, you know, rather than work with troubled youth, I was going to be a juvenile probation officer. I felt like I want to help victims of crime, and that's the direction I went. And then I had the honor of working with our attorney general and then governor and Janet Napolitano, and was able to continue to advocate for victims. And
yeah, that's great. Can I just ask, as you said, it was a random act, but did your brother have like a fancy car that they thought, oh, we have to have it, or was it just purely
no?
Well,
it was, they were already looking in the neighborhood and had been terrorizing people in the neighborhood. These two gang members and the police had been looking for them for unrelated crimes, and they had tried to rob somebody before my brother. This was 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning at an elementary school at a place my brother played basketball at for over 10 years. And so anyways, it was random. We learned in court testimony they had tried to rob somebody before my brother, and they saw him sitting there in his car and wanted the vehicle. It wasn't a fancy, you know, Mercury Sable, but it was a nice car. But they actually flipped a coin to see who was going to shoot and walked up and shot him, you know, point blank. And so My brother, you know, died, and subsequently, and my 9-year-old niece and 15-year-old nephew, and my brother's, my sister-in-law, my brother's wife were, you know, he was there one moment and gone the next, and they were left without a husband and father, and us without a brother, and my parents without a son. And so you try and make something out of something that doesn't make sense, and it just
right.
never does. It's like a book with half the pages written, ripped off. It just, you ask why, but, and they did catch both people. One is doing a life sentence, and the other got 15 years, the non-shooter, and he's actually already out of prison.
He's out already?
He was, because he agreed to testify against the shooter, they made a deal with the co-defendant. He's been subsequently deported, is from another country. So he did 85% of his 15 years.
And this was part of an initiation for a gang, or just that they belong to a gang?
No, the police thought the motivation was a robbery. I mean, they wanted his vehicle, and, you know, they saw him sitting in it, and after having tried to rob somebody else, we're not going to let this guy get away. And it was literally one of those, if not by the grace of God, there go I. It could have been anybody's brother, father, sister sitting there. And, you know, you realize it's not a one-hour TV show or a book that you read with a beginning and an end, but literally it changes your life forever, and how we deal with that.
My dad was shot in very similar circumstances to what you described. Five bullets to major organs in a vehicle. So I can totally relate to what you're saying. I'm so sorry. And sorry doesn't mean anything, but it's something that we have to acknowledge. But I think by us choosing these paths and paying it forward, we're trying to make sure that something good has come out of something horrific. I really believe that. And so, in reviewing the information about POMC, I remember going to training in Boston many years ago about POMC, and they used to give out these big fancy binders with all kinds of really good information. I don't know if they still do that.
Mm-hmm.
But, in fact, I still might have mine somewhere.
We do.
But,
we have a training every year.
Do you?
We have an effective leadership training. I mean, we do trainings periodically throughout the country, but every year, and this year it's in March, early April, we have a training in Cincinnati, and we just do basically, you know, everything about the organization and go over all the policies and procedures and working with survivors of homicide and
mm-hmm.
all that goes involved.
Do people come to Cincinnati for the training now? Or?
Yes.
You go to
yes.
them in different areas
no,
of the country?
People come to Cincinnati, and then, you know, whenever we're asked, if we've got somebody that can do the training, we'll do a training in a local area. I just got back not long ago from doing a training in Buffalo, New York, through the Office of Victims of Crime. It was not POMC directly, but the Department of Justice, Office of Victims of Crime, had a training on homicide, and I was fortunate enough to go there and be able to do a training.
Well, that's great. Why don't we talk about some of your programming? Because I think it's fairly unique in terms of what I know about it. We have at least three different things that we wanted to cover: your murder wall, the Parole Black program, and the Second Opinion Services, as well as legislation, which sounds very innovative. So take your pick, Dan. Why don't you
talk about the murder wall. Certainly is something that, jumps to the forefront of my mind, although all the programs are important, and but
instead
I think the murder wall is it's basically a traveling tribute that honors the memory of all murdered loved ones, and there's 33 odd panels with 120 names on it, and the dates of birth and date of death, and it's engraved on brass plates. And what we typically do when the wall is presented, it's set up, and as you can imagine, it's very moving and powerful, and the wall is unveiled, and we have law enforcement officers who do the unveiling in a powerful ceremony, and it sits on display wherever it goes, and it's a reminder to those not only who have been touched by violence, but those who haven't, that you know, these people
so
lived and loved.
It's in a gray plaque with their name and date that they died?
Yeah. Each panel holds 120 names. So picture, you know, a panel with 120 names on it, and then, you know, that being displayed, 30-some-odd panels, you know, it usually takes up most of the room wherever we're at. So it's and it's for a nominal fee, allows people to get their loved one's name engraved on it. And that's one of the things that, you know, I think for a lot of survivors, as you know, honoring our loved one and not forgetting them, and this is a tangible way that people can do that if they would like. And again, they can go on our website. The cost, you know, like I said, is very minimal, and it's basically to have the loved one's name inscribed on a plaque on the murder wall. It's $75, and a portion of that goes
to
the upkeep.
So it's perpetual,
as well.
And you're always adding. Is that right?
Right. Right.
Yeah, Delilah, can you tell us a little bit of the background regarding the wall of victims that Monica has? Because it's fairly similar, isn't it?
Well, what they do each year at the conference, they have a national annual national conference each year, and they have a wall with the pictures of all the missing persons that are registered with their organization, and they're, again, just like you explained earlier, they unveil the wall and pull up the curtain, and there it is. So it is. It's a very moving experience. It just takes your breath away.
Combined with the vigil, right? Right.
Yes, it is. And, you know, for first-time people who attend something like this, and I'm sure, you know, Dan, you run into the same thing, it just takes your breath away because you the general public sometimes just has no idea, and when you see something like that visually, it's astounding.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. In fact, I often think when people first see it, they do get overwhelmed with emotion. Mm-hmm. And we have one of the people who from Cincinnati, a survivor, Sharon Tewksbury, and if I could, I'll just read a short quote she said about the wall. She used to work at her national office, and her husband, Monty, was murdered. And but she said, "We always know the name of the offender, but we seldom ever see or know the name of the victim. The murder wall is a strong and loving reminder not only of my husband, Monty, but of all those who died by violence in our community." That really sums it up. Is there's also a booklet that goes along with the wall that will allow, if survivors want, to tell a story of their loved one. And then, you know, another program, which I think is unique to PLMC, is obviously our chapters are important, and we have those around the country, but the Second Opinion Service is one I wanted to mention as well, and it's a program to provide basically, like the name says, second opinion on unsolved or complicated cases, and there's different experts that will look at toxicology or police reports or medical examiner's reports. And I will say in the vast majority of the cases, you know, there's nothing that they can really do other than, you know, concur with the jurisdiction that either there's not enough to solve it or they don't know what happened. But a lot of times what it does do is give survivors at least the option of knowing that here's another set of eyes that looked at it. And there have been several cases that have been solved.
Well, What's the criteria for people submitting to them? Does it have to be like maybe, you know, 5 years old and it's considered a cold case or?
No, there's no real time frame. Usually people will come to us when the local jurisdiction or whoever, even the federal jurisdiction, would say, you know, at this point, there's not enough to go forward, or we don't know, it's an unsolved case. And so the family at that point can say, okay, well, you know, one of the things I want to do is get a second opinion. Of course, that jurisdiction, law enforcement or prosecutor's office, you know, doesn't have to listen to what the second opinion service says. We hope they do. But I guess my point is we don't have the authority or the jurisdiction, obviously, to go in and say, hey, you have to look at this. But like we said, we do get others to look at it. And if they feel there's something that maybe needs additional investigation, they can, you know, recommend that or contact the original investigative authorities. They can help provide answers and give some direction to the authorities.
Am I right that the composition of this board, if you want to say, sounds similar to the VDOC Society? I mean, are they retired judges, attorneys, private investigators?
They're typically
made up of these people, and are they volunteer?
Yeah, they're all volunteer, and, you know, depending on the case, what we'll typically do is send it to a forensic pathologist who serves on our board or actually just stepped down from our board after over 20 years of service, Dr. Bunnell out of San Diego, who's an international expert on forensic, and he is somebody that, you know, will look at it. We also have a detective that's or a media person, or we have used the VDOC Society before, which is criminal profilers. It just really depends on the case. A lot of it is medical related, where we'll get sometimes a medical examiner or, you know, somebody saying this was the cause of death. And so many of the cases do go to Dr. Bunnell.
Have you ever approached Dr. Henry Lee? You know, he's based here in my state, and I had the extreme pleasure of going to his facility and doing a two-hour special there, and he's supportive of this show and whatnot. I just wondered.
Yeah, well, I have a colleague and friend, Judge Ron Reinstein, who does a lot of trainings, and he knows Dr. Lee, and we have not, I don't believe, and used him as one of our experts, but it's certainly something, you know, that we'd always
that
be
you
open
want
to
think
to.
About.
Yeah, no, we're always, you know, as long as somebody is, you know, willing and able to, and it, like I said, it's a volunteer program, so we are really appreciative of those that can give their expertise, because I kind of compare it to, God forbid, if you were diagnosed with some sort of ailment, more than likely we're going to go get a second opinion and at least see what someone else thinks. And a lot of times in cases, in all jurisdictions, if it's not solved, not always, but many times people feel like, well, they didn't work my case, or they, you know, there's a conspiracy or whatever the case may be, and really, and we don't lose sight of it, the heroes are the men and women of law enforcement and prosecutors and victim advocates, and we're in no way, you know, second guessing them per se. It's just another set of eyes that maybe or expertise that maybe could help, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah, particularly of people that live in very small towns that are lacking resources. So just to put it in proper context, because we do have a national audience, people may be listening to this and saying, oh, maybe I can submit my case. Is if you have to be a POMC member in order to submit information to be considered for this service, and how would that work? And is it viable to say this?
Yeah, I mean, anybody that's interested, and again, I'll say, you know, our website is www.pomc.com, and mm-hmm. at the homepage, there's a tab up top that says Second Opinion, and you don't need to be, although, you know, we don't have membership, you know, fee or anything like that. Really, anybody that has lost a loved one is a member just by the virtue of their horrific circumstance, and if they'd like you know, they can go on, and there's a form to fill out at the on the website, or they can call our national office toll-free at 888-818-7662, or it stands for POMC, the 7662, and we'd be happy to give them the information and let them know, you know, whether their case. No, but it does take some time, and we ask people to, you know, be patient, and usually, you know, we can get back to them in a fairly reasonable amount of time.
Right. Delilah, I just wanted to maybe make a comment, or maybe you can comment, because you historically were with this situation longer than I, what with CrimeWire and Susan and Denny. How did that initially get started? Because it kind of reminded me of the methods that they used. Can you just give people
it is very similar. It's very similar in the sense that, you know, they were able to use not only their own backgrounds, their own investigative backgrounds, with, you know, with Denny being in law enforcement and Susan's background, pulling things together from a lot of different resources they had. And they were, you know, they were able to, they're again, just like you're doing, give a case some new eyes, because it's amazing how little teeny tiny clues that are overlooked by this organization or this department or this person investigating, it can be, you know, they're seen by someone else. Not that it was purposely overlooked, it just, it happens. So, you know, they were able to work on a lot of cases like that together, and bringing in different investigators that that they had. And then the radio show. The radio shows were really great, because a lot of the cases that came to them were older cases that people had generally forgotten about, or, you know, had not made news ever. So they were able to get some media started. And many, you know, many of the cases that they started out with ended up going national. So, you know, it takes that little fire starter in the beginning to get it going. So radio shows like this do serve a very, very good purpose.
Yes, that's a great point, Delilah.
I miss CrimeWire. I miss Kim too, but maybe she'll be back soon, we hope. But hers is a little bit of a different focus than what they used to do. So, Dan, I think that's wonderful. I think it's tremendous, and I hope people will take advantage of that. Do you want to talk about the Parole Black program, or do you want to get into the legislation?
And before I forget, I also, if I could, just want to mention, too, our national conference is next summer in Rochester, Minnesota, August 14th through the 17th. And, again, I keep mentioning our website, but people can go there for more information. But the Parole Black program, what that program basically does is if a family or an individual contacts us regarding the murder of their loved one who's coming up for parole, we will circulate petitions. And by the way, I should mention there, again, for the second opinion service, there is a $50 processing fee, but that basically just goes to make copies of all the reports so we can send them to the different experts.
That makes sense. That's good.
And then in the parole block, we, at the request of survivors, we will write and circulate petitions to stop the early release of murderers. And we've averaged, you know, one a week pretty much since the program's been started. And we've just, it's kind of like our voice in numbers and being able to have, you know, in some cases, you know, 80, 100,000 signatures or, you know, less being presented to the parole board. At least we've been told by parole boards that it's impactful and that it does make a difference. And I think what it does is for survivors, it allows them to be empowered to not just sit back and sort of, well, it's all at the hands of the parole board or the board of clemency or whoever's hearing it. And while at the end of the day it may be, there's certainly impact that I think signatures and petitions give to the parole boards to say this person meant a lot to a lot of people. And, you know,
right.
The person was sentenced to life and they should get life or whatever the case may be, and not an early release.
Right. I personally know that the power of even one person doing something because of the outcome of our parole. Go ahead, Delilah.
Excuse me, I was just going to say, I would think in a state like Connecticut, who, you know, very controversially had a lot of early release and what they've found, and I'm sure there's other states that have done the same thing, isn't there, Dan? And how, you know, is POMC behind stopping this in some way?
Yeah, I mean, I think our general, you know, and obviously every case and every survivor is different. I've learned that over the years. And you know, for some people, they, you know, don't want to protest the release. But I would say for the majority, you know, and a lot of states do have early release where a family may have heard, you know, okay, life, but life didn't mean life, and it meant 20
right.
years or 25 years, and they have to go every 6 months in these, you know, parole hearings or every year or however often they are.
Okay.
And so, yeah, we do protest those.
Is there any way for you to track the success of the petitions that
yes.
are sent out? Like, do you keep that data?
Yes. We basically, the information, once we ask that people let us know what the outcome is so that we can go ahead and, you know, track that and have those information. And, you know, most of the time people do follow up and let us know that it was successful in, you know, blocking the early release. And, I mean, it's well over 1,000 since the inception of the program, which was in 1990. And
so you've had impact, positive impact on 1,000 cases when you've done
that. At least. I mean, that's, I'm looking
wow.
at probably some older stats, but, you know, I know that it's been
that's
very
great.
Successful. And it's, you know, I'm looking at some statistics that just from the Bureau of Justice, the average maximum sentence length for murder was 20 years and 11 months. And again, this, you know,
mm-hmm.
isn't, you know, it's a couple years old, the data, but it just shows that, you know, when we hear life, it's not always life.
Right. No, it's not at all. No. Well, I think that's a wonderful program, and it shows how the impact that you're making, and I'm really glad that we're getting that out there to people. And, you know, maybe, again, that's another vehicle that our listeners can use when the situation comes up, if it's appropriate. You know, when we chatted on the phone a few weeks ago, you told me some very interesting pieces of legislation that you are contemplating introducing. So I wondered if you would talk about that with restitution and something regarding pre-police services.
Yeah, I mean, some of this is stuff that, and it's fairly recent public policy, although some goes back a few years, but when I worked at the governor's office and the attorney general's office, we were fortunate, I was fortunate, I felt like victims here in Arizona had the ear of the governor or the attorney general, and one of the, I think, most impactful pieces of legislation that we were able to pass when I was working for the governor was to change our restitution statute, and we actually modeled it after California, but the idea was to be able to collect meaningful amounts of restitution from incarcerated inmates. We had a law here, and many states do, where a percentage of their wages are taken to go towards court-ordered restitution. And for
okay.
instance, here in Arizona, it was 30% of your wages. So if you're earning 50 cents an hour, a whole 15 cents was going towards restitution. But meanwhile, and some did, an inmate could have hundreds, even thousands of dollars in their wage and trust accounts that are sent in from family and friends and others. And so we changed it to where you can take now, the director of corrections can set it at anywhere from 20 to 50% of mail money that's sent in. So somebody sends in $100 and $20 will go at least towards restitution. We saw a dramatic increase in the collections of restitution once that statute passed. And we'd like to see across the country more meaningful amounts of restitution. And again, we don't want to make people indigent or you know, penalize them beyond, but oftentimes restitution is neglected. And once someone is sentenced, it's like, well, what about the restitution for? For some people, it's for funeral, or it's just meaningful to know that the offender is paying back, at least in one way.
Is it earmarked for specific purposes, or can they use it for whatever?
Well, the money, when it comes in, is it's given to the inmate, and before it's deposited into their account, 20% is taken for restitution.
Right,
and,
but I mean, the 20%, can the surviving family use it for whatever?
Yeah, if the family, I mean, it has to be court order. I mean, they can, the family, if it goes to them, they can use it for whatever they want. But if, and in some cases, families say, I want the restitution to go to, you know, whatever, ABC, an organization, and sometimes the courts will order that. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, the restitution, it's for the economic loss that was caused by the crime. So in homicide, that's typically funeral and medical expenses.
Right. And I think these days the funerals typically cost about $7,000 is the last figure that I read. Now, how quickly does that happen in terms of the restitution, the turnaround time?
I believe, well, and again, I'm going by here in Arizona, I believe the clerk of the court will not send the check out if it's below $10. So sometimes, you know, it's every month that restitution should be being paid to
every month
victims. Yeah, they'll send out a
not
check.
Not a lump sum, then. No, it's just every
no
month.
unless they pay a lump sum. I mean, whatever is paid by the offender. I mean, they're usually court ordered to pay a certain amount, and then, like in corrections, like I said, 20% goes towards that amount. But sometimes that's what was one of the catalysts, is there was an inmate who got, you know, $14,000 or $15,000 from the sale of her house, and before the statute passed, refused to work, and the victim, you know, wanted their restitution. And while the DOC would write them up and say, you know, for not working, there was no way for the victim to get the money. And so we just call it more, I guess, meaningful amounts and making it meaningful to victims to collect.
That's great. Hey, we've got about 12 minutes or so just to let you know about the time here.
Okay.
And before I forget, I just want to ask you with regard to your conference in August, and I know there's a fundraiser you sent to me regarding bowling in January 25th, I believe, right?
Right.
You can talk about that, but wondered, is there a theme to this conference, and are you looking for presenters with people with expertise in homicide matters, or how do you get your speakers?
Yes and yes to both of those. The theme this year is Rebuilding Shattered Lives, Renewing Hope for Tomorrow. That's the theme.
It's an omen.
And we are looking
for. Yeah,
he had
my phone number. You can call me.
Yeah, and we, I mean, one of the things as a nonprofit, obviously, we typically can't pay speakers or people to come in, so we kind of draw from them this year in Minnesota and trying to tap their expertise, but we do are able to get some national speakers to come in. And one national speaker that is coming in, I'll just mention this real quickly. I'm a college wrestling fan, but because my boys wrestle, but Dan Gable is coming to speak. And Mr. Gable is an Olympic gold medalist in wrestling and an NCAA championship coach for 15, 20 years for Iowa. He's a legend. But when he was growing up, his a sister was murdered in Waterloo, Iowa, where he was a teenager, and he's going to come and speak about the impact that that had on his life and the drive that it caused him to become the best in the world, and how he just trained in her honor. So I'm excited about that.
Sounds inspiring. So he's a keynote, huh?
Yes, and you know, our conferences provide numerous workshops on grief and navigating the confusing maze of the judicial and investigative process, as well as trainings for survivors and professionals. We hope to have the brochure up on the website here in the next few weeks.
Okay, well, that's great. We'll look forward to it. I'll just say, keep me in mind.
We will.
Okay, good.
Well, you can broadcast your show live. That would just tie in great.
Hey,
yeah.
There's an idea for you.
Rochester's not that far.
I know there's a reason why I keep her on this show. She thinks it's such good things.
Good idea, Dylan.
Yes, yes, we'll have to talk. We'll have to talk. Anyway, well, I digress here. I just want to get that in because, you know, it is so hard to get the information out there to people on this topic. And in this economy, it's so hard for organizations like yours and NOVA and all these other places and the Q Center to pay people. So we have to draw a line in the sand and decide what is more important in terms of certain things. So I just wanted to make that statement out there that you know, we're all looking to be educated and to educate others. And, you know, none of us are rich. But if we can, you know, borrow from Peter to pay Paul to do something, then that's what we need to do, you know. So anyway, I'll just leave it at that.
Let's talk a little bit more.
We got like 9 minutes. Why don't we talk about some of the other legislation that you were championing that we talked about.
And I did want to also leave a moment, if we can, for the little homicide grief passage that
I wanted to read. Okay, well, we will, I promise. I'll watch
let me
clock.
Know. Okay. I think one of the other ones that, again, here in Arizona, which I'm proud, Arizona has long been a leader in the victims' rights movement, but another one is the Crime Victims Leave Act, which allows victims, you know, we have a constitutional right in many states and in statutes to attend court proceedings, but at what cost? So here we have a Crime Victims Leave Act that allows victims to take unpaid leave to go to court proceedings without the fear of being demoted or losing their job. Right. And then we also have judges reading victims' rights in court every day. Just like the defendant, rightly so, here's their rights when they're arrested and then given an attorney to protect those rights, and then at the arraignment what those rights are and the change of plea, what rights are giving up. We felt like, you know, the victim should hear from the judge, the gatekeeper, you know, out loud what their rights are, and so we're proud that we were one of the first states to have that, just to reiterate to the victim.
At every proceeding, every judicial proceeding, the presiding judge reads the rights
during a status conference, change of plea, and sentencing, and so it's every judge. So what they'll do is say, you know, if there's a victim here today, you have the following rights, and they'll read the victim's bill of rights. Plus, it's also mandated that they be posted in every courtroom. So it's not every single hearing, but it is at certain key points. At least hopefully victims will hear, hey, I've got the right to be treated with dignity and respect. Also, free police reports for crime victims. Again, at the time, the governor felt like, well, why should victims be a revenue stream for any municipality? And for my brother's police report, I had to pay over, you know, $200 at 40 cents a sheet or whatever. And so the concept is, well, you know, the defendant gets a free copy through their attorney. Shouldn't victims' families get a copy as well? And so those are just a couple things.
So did taxpayers foot the bill for that? I mean, gratefully, because at least that's giving, you know.
Yeah, generally, I mean, each department's different on where they, but for a lot of them it was a revenue stream. And so, yeah, now it's basically free to the victim, and the cost of copying it or redacting it would fall to the city or municipality or the state or the county. And so, yeah, it's one of those things, instead of putting it just on the victim.
And then we also we have the Constitutional Victim Rights Amendment that we're all aware of, thanks to Jennifer Bishop Jenkins and others. We talked about that, but you're leading the charge on that too, right?
Yeah, we're working with, lots of people, Steve Twist and Brooks Douglas and, of course, Jennifer and many others, on an effort to get a constitutional amendment to our U.S. Constitution. And Trent Franks, who's from Arizona, and Jim Costa, a bipartisan effort, have introduced a Victims' Rights Amendment in Congress. And hopefully that'll pass to basically give victims of crime fundamental, what we consider human rights, to be informed and involved, and the right to notice, and to participate in certain proceedings. And so I encourage people who want more information on that to go to the National Victims Constitutional Amendment Passage website, and that's www.nvcap.org.
And that's got
a lot of good information.
Now, are all of these, with the exception of the constitutional amendment, the legislation that you made reference to, are those things that have already been enacted or things that are coming up to be voted on?
Those are things that have already, at least here in Arizona, been enacted over the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
There have actually been several that have been introduced in Congress, but they haven't gone anywhere. Such as a Victims Leave Act that would allow, on a federal level.
Right.
When a child's brought into the world, rightly so, those parents get time off under the Family Medical Leave Act. But if the same child is taken by violence, you're lucky if you get 3 days bereavement leave, and then
Right. You're
expected to be back at work.
When my dad was killed, I was working in a hospital as a speech pathologist, and all they had was maternity leave. And I said, well, that's not appropriate. I'm still going. I don't care.
Right.
It's a trial.
Right.
Yeah. Can you believe that?
I
know. It is really incredible. Before we read the passage that you would like, and on behalf of your friend who has authored the book, I want to ask you, what is it that we as a national audience can do? And I know that I talked to you a little bit. Maybe we can provide some resources with regard to your particular website about, maybe getting the word out a little better because, people still are not really aware. I know there's a separate website for the people in California, right? At least that's what I saw, a POMC website. But what is it that you're really in need of, and is there something that we can do as listeners to help?
Yeah, well, a couple different things, and all the website for the chapters are on our website, the national website, but I think what we need help is raising awareness to let people know that we exist and that we're available, us or any organization. And, of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't say, we also are in need of funding and, people, if they choose, can make a donation online.
You accept donations?
Yes, people can go online and make a donation on our homepage. And there's a button that says, please donate now. And again, it's www.pomc.com. And then I think the other thing, and this is by no means any less important, but I think, being there for people, and it sounds almost, basic, but not just in the beginning after someone's loved one is murdered, but in the weeks and months. And as you know, Donna, how important that is in years to have that support. And that's what we try and do, is provide that ongoing emotional support for people. It's not for everybody. Some people may not want to go to a support group, but some may find it very, very helpful.
Right. I totally agree with you. And people just want to have other people to listen and to understand and to be able to relate. So that is important. We will be sure to keep you in our collaborative family, Dan.
Thank you.
Why don't you take that, tell us a little background of that passage that you'd like to introduce that, and then we'll close out with that. And tomorrow we will write a blog about this, and we will circulate as well. And just so that everyone knows, if they're not listening right now from 5 to 6 Eastern or in Dan's time period, you can listen at any time, anywhere, repeatedly on our archives. That's the beauty of blogtalkradio.com and this radio show, of which we are very proud. Okay, Dan?
All right.
I give you the floor.
Well, and thank you. And again, I want to thank Donna and Delilah for having me. And a friend of mine wrote a book after her brother was murdered called Aftermath in the Wake of Murder. It's a wonderful book, and her name is Carrie Freitag, F-R-E-I-T-A-G. And one passage from her book, with her permission, she allowed me to tweak a little bit and make personal for my brother's case, but if I can, I'll go ahead and read it. It's called Homicide Grief, and homicide grief is the yearning to say one last goodbye. It's clenching your teeth until you have a headache that won't go away. It's a field of fog and distance where we wander lost and aimless. It's dreaming about our loved one and not being able to think of anything else. It's wondering why fate chose them and not me. It's the fear of living with the loss and the fear of losing more. It is an identity crisis that ensues when we lose those who help define who we are, how we live, and how we relate to one another. It's panning through memories over and over, searching for jewels, and it's looking at old family pictures and yearning for that day so long ago in the past. And finally, homicide grief is wondering where your loved one really is and if they can see you, hear you, or read your mind. It's waving or calling to them just in case. And I'm not sure how we're doing on time.
Yeah, we're about out of time.
Okay.
But
well,
I
encourage people to get the book.
Okay, give us that information again quickly.
Sure, it's called Aftermath.
Yeah.
It's called Aftermath in the Wake of Murder, and it's by Carrie Freitag.
Okay, very
F-R-E-I-T-A-G.
Good. Well, thank you so much, Dan. We really appreciate you being with us this evening. It's been a wonderful and inspirational time. Delilah, thank you so much. We will be in touch with you, and I'll say good evening, everyone. Have a warm and safe evening, and we will see you next Saturday for another edition of Saturday Night. Okay, Dan,
yes.
Have a